From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. Mother's Day is right around the corner, and today we welcome the ultimate mama's boy.
So you had me come out here under false pretenses?
You wouldn't come here any other way. You haven't seen me in a year. It's why I went to Army, to win you back. You have to forgive me.
It's not about forgiving you, although I don't. Mm. You need to grow up, Buster, because I can't take care of you anymore.
The son you just heard there is played by actor Tony Hale. We talked to him about his role as Buster Bluth on the great TV show Arrested Development. But first, primatologist Franz DeWall joined us recently to talk about how animals are so much smarter than we often give them credit for.
Language and reading and writing and technology, and we are very strong in that. And so we have tried to judge animals on those terms. And there are species, you know, like, why would we make that comparison? Is that really interesting to know? Are you smarter than an octopus? Well, in your environment, with what you daily do, you are obviously very smart. But in the octopus's environment, who knows how you would be faring? We don't know.
We wanted to know about the animals in your life. How intelligent are they? Here are your first thoughts. Edward Austin Hall sent us this tweet containing a James Bond reference. My smallest cat, Sebastian, rules the roost over one older female and one larger male. I keep all my computers locked away from the cats, lest they engage in the behavior I'm sure Blofeld's white kitty did whenever off camera. You know, destabilizing currencies, arming both sides in global skirmishes, extorting politicians of lesser intellect, ... Wow, quite a thing there, Edward. Robert Grizzle tweets this picture of a cutie named Bella, his dog, and says, she helped me earn my BA in history and helped me write a lot of my papers. Okay, neat. Allison Saunders also sent us a photo of her dog. She says, Mud isn't that smart, but he sure is cute. Allison, I find that more believable than the comments by the prior two listeners. But we always want to hear from you listeners, whatever you have to say, fictitious or not. We certainly welcome pictures of your pets. We are on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Some shows become cult classics. Arrested Development is one of them. It premiered on Fox in 2003 and was then canceled after only three seasons. In 2013, though, Netflix revived the series for a fourth season, and now we hear they are making a fifth one. This makes me very happy. I love Arrested Development. Tony Hale plays the youngest child of the family, Mama's boy, Buster Bluth, on the program.
I never want to look at Mom again.
What happened?
I can't really talk. She might be listening in. Do you know she tried to set up my girlfriend with a man? I'm a man.
So there's Tony Hale in Arrested Development. You may also know Tony Hale as personal assistant to the President of the United States on HBO's Veep.
I see you. You stay away from my face.
I hear you. But this is a family recipe for my aunts in Savannah, and they swear by it for skin problems and migraines. Mm-hmm. Chickpea paste, Tabasco with just a dash.
All you're doing right now is making me hungry.
Right.
Tony Hale is not from Georgia, but he spends a lot of time here. His parents live in the Macon area, and I talked with him about his career.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. I'm struck by how your two most famous characters are just very, very similar personas. They are naive. They are easily manipulated. They're a little bit dopey. And I suppose what I really want you to just do now is, like, behave so I can know whether or not any of that comes from who you really are.
Oh, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I know there's definitely a lot of similarities in the two, but the way I look at it is Gary, which I play on Veep. I think he would probably take care of Buster. Buster needs a Gary in his life.
Yes, Gary is competent.
Gary's competent, and Buster can barely get out of the house.
Right. As we mentioned, you didn't grow up in Middle Georgia. You grew up in Tallahassee, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the most culturally southern of Florida cities, I would argue. Do your southern roots inform your character?
Well, I went to school in Birmingham, Alabama, and my character on Veep, Gary, is from Birmingham, Alabama. So that was something I added when we were shooting. I was like, I'm going to make him from Birmingham.
Certainly, but is he a personality that you encountered in this part of the country?
No, I think it was just kind of an homage to just my Southern roots. But I'm trying to think. I'm not sure. There's glimmers of him everywhere because I lived in New York for many years. You know, he's a hodgepodge of a lot.
Well, where did he come from? I mean, he's such a particular persona. Where did you assemble him from?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, I think I've been asked that question with Buster and Gary a lot, and it scares me how naturally they came to me. So I don't know what that says about me. But I will say, like, he's a guy who has been with Selena Meyer, who's played by Julia, for probably over 15 years, and
right. He's,
you know, probably a kid who never really had much of an identity, so he hooked on to somebody who had a really strong personality, and then her identity became his identity, and he's very content with that. He's not a guy who evolves. He's what's called a body man, and where they carry around a bag, and they have whatever their representative needs. In my case, it's Selena Meyer. And, you know, most people, I met a guy who did that in D.C. years ago, and he did it in his 20s, and then you get burned out and you move on to other things. Mm-hmm. My character has stayed into his 40s and doesn't know any life outside of Selena Meyer and doesn't want to know any life outside of Selena Meyer. He's very content being right by her side.
Now President Meyer is played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You two had actually worked together back on Arrested Development. She guest starred on the series in season one as a lawyer. Let's listen to a scene where she is interrogating Buster about his father's allegedly illegal business activity.
Do you know anything about your father's trips overseas?
I knew I'd have a fun time at home alone with Mom.
Fine. Did you ever see him return from these trips? With anything unusual?
He came back home once with a black statue with an erect penis.
What about business associates?
I have none.
All right. This guy's wasting our time. Take away his grilled cheese.
Man, you and Julia Louis-Dreyfus have phenomenal chemistry. What's it like working with her?
Well, what's funny is, well, it's amazing to work with her, but when we were, we've been asked about working on Arrested Development together because she played the blind lawyer and I was Buster, and we were both asked at separate times, did we have scenes together on Arrested? And both of us were like, nope.
And then you forgot about that one.
Someone sent us each a screenshot of us sitting across from each other having a scene. So clearly it didn't make much of an impact on either one of our lives.
It made a huge impact on us in the audience, I can tell you.
Well, that's good.
So much so that we pulled the wrong clip.
Perfect. See, it's happening all over the place.
Exactly.
She's pretty fantastic. She's what's called number one on the call sheet, where the lead on the show is the first person listed on the call sheet, and whoever that person is really sets the tone for the show. And sometimes, unfortunately, that person is very arrogant and entitled, and it sets a real tense environment. Everybody's kind of walking on eggshells. Or you have someone like Julia, who's incredibly kind and creative, and she's a team player, and everybody kind of throws ideas in, and it really helps the kind of creative energy and just the whole show. And the other side, that tension just sucks creative energy out of a room. So we're very grateful for the environment we have.
Yeah, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, another actor who seems to be the polar opposite from the character she so often plays, which is she's kind of a professional jerk on television. I would say that both of these series that we've been talking about, Arrested Development and Veep, kind of epitomize the contemporary single camera comedy style, almost mockumentary. That's a term that gets thrown around a lot, single camera show. For newbies, how would you define a single camera show? How does the number of cameras you're using on set really affect the tenor of the program?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to look at it is when you hear something like multicam. I apologize if there's a beeping in the back. Okay, good. I think my fire alarm's battery.
I mean, if your house is on fire, that's probably something that you should address.
What if it was, and I was like, nope, public radar's more important.
Well, you've got 3 minutes left, so only so much damage can occur.
But I think the really quick difference is there's something called multicam, which is like a typical, like a Big Bang Theory where it's on a set and a studio audience. And then single camera is kind of shot like a film. And our comedy, even though it's called single camera and it's shot like a film, there's typically two or three cameras on set with comedy, so you can get the reactions back and forth if you improv, so you're not missing any kind of, you know, if you're shooting one side, then you could also get the other side.
But for some reason, this style of shooting seems to be associated with smarter, more intellectual comedy. Is there any causal relationship there, or is it purely correlative?
I would say probably a part of that is with single camera, you can get a lot more subtlety, and the jokes can be more subtle. For lack of a better word, it can kind of be smaller, so it doesn't have to be so broad.
Huh.
And I think with that kind of smart, not smart, but just kind of smaller things, the subtle things you can cap, you can maybe make it more dense. It doesn't have to be so in your face. So maybe that's why.
Right, yeah. I suppose if you're acting on a set for a multi-camera sitcom or something, it's more like being on the stage. It's more like theater, so you're acting bigger.
Exactly. And I think it's just the jokes are a little, can potentially be more set up or more obvious, whereas with single camera, like with our show, sometimes the joke is like maybe it's a wide shot and the joke is landing, someone's saying it, but you just see their back, but it's very subtle. So you can kind of catch things like that, and maybe people label that as smarter.
We're talking to Tony Hale, actor from Veep and Arrested Development and many other things. Brilliant, brilliant guy. Love his characters. Tony, you get back to Macon to visit your folks pretty often. What's your impression of the region?
Well, my brother also lives in Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
And so I love Georgia. I love coming down south. And my wife is also from Alabama. And we met in New York, but she's from Alabama. And then I go down to Florida, so I get my full southern trip. But I love coming down. Great restaurants. I don't know. It's just nice. So this L.A. is, we love living in L.A., but it's a different vibe. So it's nice to get down south and kind of chill out.
Yeah, in 20 seconds, what's a character that you want to play with in the rest of your career who would be very, very different from Gary or Buster Bluth?
Oh, man, in 20 seconds?
Sorry.
That's all right. No, my simple answer is just like, look, I'm so happy for a gig, so whatever comes, I'm pretty content.
All right. Atlanta's burgeoning film industry noted that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm telling you, that place is booming. With
sure
film
is.
Stuff.
Absolutely is. All right, Tony Hale, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That's actor Tony Hale. He stars in Netflix's Arrested Development. The show's fourth season was re-edited and re-released last week, and a fifth season debuts later this month. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Nearly two-thirds of Georgia's prison population is comprised of African-American men. That's many times larger than their representation in the population as a whole within the state. The Georgia Department of Correction cites new data indicating that jailing of black inmates in Georgia has actually dropped 30% over the last 8 years. That's a historic low, they say. But there is still a very large racial imbalance in Georgia prisons. I talked about what's behind this phenomenon with Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Bill Rankin, who has been following this story, and also with Yale law professor James Forman Jr. Forman is the author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. He also won a Pulitzer Prize this year. James, I want to start with you. Let's just begin with the big question. Why are African-American men locked up at such disproportionate rates, not only in Georgia, but nationwide?
Well, starting in the late 1960s, early 1970s, two things happened. We had a rise in crime, but then most importantly, what we had was a massive increase in what people call tough-on-crime policies. So mandatory minimum sentencing, aggressive policing and prosecution of drug offenses, eliminating parole, denying people bail. And so at all stages of the criminal justice system, we got tougher, we got harder, we got more punitive. And that was concentrated, not exclusively, but concentrated in African-American communities and African-American men. So that's what's created this devastation.
So we were talking about how this problem persists in Georgia. However, the State Department of Corrections says we are currently in Georgia at a historic low in terms of the incarceration of black males. It's dropped 30% over the last 8 years. Bill, what's behind that change?
Well, also, I think what's notable is that last year, the number of African Americans being sent to state prison was the lowest for any single year in three decades, which is pretty astonishing.
Is that the rate or the overall number?
The overall number. Wow. Number of black inmates in a single year was the lowest number for 1 year in 30 years. I cannot say, you know, certainly what's behind it, but we do know three things for sure. Mm-hmm. And one is that the crime rate has dropped. Second, you have fewer people committing crimes. You have fewer people going to prison. As part of the Georgia's criminal justice reform package a few years ago, the legislature changed the felony threshold for theft crimes. It used to be if you stole $500 worth of goods or forged more than $500 worth of money in a check, you had a felony. But now it's $1,500, which is in keeping with a lot of other states. So mm-hmm. that has had a huge impact on the number of people going to prison, as well as, finally, is the enormous expansion of accountability courts across Georgia. Governor Nathan,
explain what that is.
Accountability court, they treat substance abuse, people with substance abuse, mental illness, veterans who are having problems. These are people who are charged with felonies, and they go to like a drug court. It takes about 18 months. Every morning you call to see if you have to do a urine test. You have to have a job. You have to get counseling. You have to show up in court. If you fail a drug test, you're going to go to jail for a few days. But if you complete the course, it takes about 18 months. The state will dismiss the charges. So a lot of these people were going to prison many years ago, and now they're getting counseling and hopefully, returning to society and becoming successful.
Yeah, we talked with Atlantan Matt Cook, who has been arrested 38 times in his life, he told us. He finally broke the cycle by going to one of the new drug accountability courts in Georgia, which provides resources to help keep people like him out of prison. Max says that it has changed his life as well as the lives of others. Let's listen.
You know, that program, it definitely gave me the unseen essential that I needed in my life. And that unseen essential was structure. That was the main ingredient missing from my life, some type of structure. Like I said, during my time in that program, I've seen countless other people make it through, and I also witnessed their life change as well.
We're talking about a significant drop in the incarceration numbers of black men in Georgia over the last few years. However, black men still are being locked up in Georgia at a vastly disproportionate rate, very similar to phenomenon going on across the country. Going back to James Forman Jr. at Yale Law School, what do you make of this drop in black male incarceration in Georgia?
Well, it's part of a nationwide trend, and I think the significant thing is it's connected to what Bill said. So these numbers are dropping at the same time as crime is dropping. And this is true in Texas, this is true in New York, it's true in Connecticut. In all of these states, we've had 20 to 30% drops in prison going, and also 20 to 30% declines in crime. And the reason why that's so important is that for the longest time, people said, if you take some of the steps that Georgia has started to take, then crime is going to go up. And that turns out not to be true, which I think then creates the political climate. It creates the emotional climate in a community and in a state where you can start to then push further and try to create even more progress.
That said, the criminal justice reforms that we've been talking about under the Nathan Deal administration in Georgia are only a few years old. Violent crime in particular has been plummeting nationwide since its peak in the early 90s. Do we know what's behind that broader trend? It can't be criminal justice reform, right?
The criminologists have been debating why crime rose in the 60s and in the late 80s, and they've been debating why crime has declined over the last two decades. And, I mean, if you put 10 criminologists in a room, you're going to get 10 different theories for why it happened. And most of them will admit it. You know, we really don't know. I can't prove to you that my theory is better than the next person's theory. And So, and it's actually been an international trend. Crime has declined across other countries as well over the last two decades. So it's very, very hard to say. You know, there people theorize about a reduction in amount of lead exposure for young kids. People point to some of the sentencing policies probably deserve some credit. Some of the tough on crime policies, I think probably a small amount, but they deserve a little bit of the credit. There's been a huge, at the community level, you've seen over the last two or three decades, lots of people, churches, neighborhood groups, civic associations, NAACP, fraternities and sororities, they've looked at this crisis in the Black community, and a lot of neighborhood folks are starting to step up and say, can we create alternative programs for young people in our communities to help divert them from the criminal system? So I think all of these different forces have helped to play a role.
One of the factors behind that has been the growth of drug accountability courts in Georgia, courts that are designed to divert nonviolent and small-time drug offenders into better options than long-term incarceration. We had spoken with Atlantan Matt Cook, someone who'd been arrested many, many times in his life, and says he broke the cycle by getting sent to drug accountability court. Here he is again. He says that most of the arrests that he sees are for small drug possession crimes, including his own.
I got to be honest, right? You know, when I got arrested for selling cocaine to a GBI agent, it wasn't that I was a drug dealer. I was trying to get high myself. So what they say is a sale case, I saw as an opportunity for me to feed my addiction. You know, however, I did make the same, so yes, I was guilty of that. But it wasn't that I was a drug dealer, I was a drug user.
And Mac is exactly the kind of person who might have been sent away to prison for a very long time.
He was
under tough on crime circumstances. And increasingly, that's not the case in Georgia for offenders like him. James Forman Jr. with Yale Law School, in the last minute that we have left, what's the next frontier in criminal justice reform? What hasn't yet been done that could be done to reduce mass incarceration nationwide?
Well, I think the first thing is connected to Matt's story. So it's great that he's getting this treatment through these accountability courts. But think how much better it would be if those treatment options were available to people outside of the court system entirely. So we need to build up our community-based network of treatment alternatives so that people who are addicts like that gentleman was, can go and get that treatment in the first instance before they're ever arrested, before they're processed, right? Because that process itself, even if he goes into an accountability court, ends up having a lot of collateral harm. So I think the next stage is to push more of these programs even further to the front end so people are never arrested in the first instance.
That's James Forman Jr., professor at Yale Law School, author of the book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. We were also speaking to Bill Rankin, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, talking about a decline in the number of incarcerated black men in Georgia. It's a historic low, according to the State Department of Corrections. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Novelist Jesmyne Ward writes stories about the South. In 2011, she won the National Book Award for Salvage the Bones, a novel about a family's survival after Hurricane Katrina. Her latest novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing, won the National Book Award last year. It centers around a young African-American boy in Mississippi who is forced to care for his younger sister. His white father is incarcerated and his black mother is a drug addict. Jesmyne Ward speaks tonight at the Carter Center in Atlanta. We talked to her in 2014 about her memoir, Men We Reaped. It focuses on the deaths of five men in Ward's life. It begins in 2000 when her brother Joshua was killed by a drunk driver. Ward explains to GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley why she chose to structure her life story around death.
When I was living through the events that I write about in the book, part of me knew that this was something that I'd have to eventually write about. But I put it off for years because I didn't want to face it. You know, I didn't want to write about it. I didn't want to have to work with all this painful material and, you know, tell these, you know, horrible stories about what had happened to me and to my loved ones. So the events that I lived through, they were so awful that I felt like, you know, that people needed to know, like people needed to, you know, realize that this sort of specter of like young black men dying and of young black people dying in general, that this isn't just something that happens, you know, in northern urban cities or in urban cities, you know, period. Like this is something that is happening throughout the United States. And so, you know, I felt a responsibility to share that and to talk about it because, you know, because I just thought that we should be part of that conversation.
The title comes from this quote from Harriet Tubman. I'll read it really quickly. "We saw the lightning and that was the guns, and then we heard the thunder and that was the big guns, and then we heard the rain falling and that was the blood falling, and when we came to get in the crops, it was dead men that we reaped." Mm-hmm. How do you write this so that it's not just a memorial to these five men?
Well, because I think that, you know, underlying there's an underlying question in the book, right? The underlying question is, why would an epidemic like this occur in the kind of place that I'm from, right? I'm from this small, rural, poor town in Mississippi, right?
Everybody knows everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, families have lived there for generations, right? So why would something like this, right, happen in a place like that? So that's that question that I ask. And then I hope, you know, that I discover an answer, right? So it's not just about, you know, memorializing these young men. It's about being able to see that there was a greater cause in their deaths. For me, like the answer that I come to at the end of the book is that, you know, the weight of history, the weight of this legacy, right, where black people have been told for hundreds of years that they are worth less, that this legacy lives in the present.
I'm hoping you'll read for us. This is a scene from, you're at a crawfish boil. We call them crawdads when I grew up. And one of the people there asks you to write about him.
Mm-hmm.
And you respond. Maybe you'd read just that portion for us.
Okay. "I don't write real life stuff," I said. It was my stock response for that suggestion. But even as I said it, I experienced a sort of dissonance. I knew the boys in my first novel, which I was writing at that time, weren't as raw as they could be. Weren't real. I knew they were failing as characters because I wasn't pushing them to assume the reality that my real-life boys, Damon among them, experienced every day. I loved them too much. As an author, I was a benevolent god. I protected them from death, from drug addiction, from needlessly harsh sentences in jail for doing stupid juvenile things like stealing four-wheel ATVs. All of the young black men in my life, in my community, had been prey to these things in real life, and yet, in the lives I imagined for them, I avoided the truth. I couldn't figure out how to love my characters less, how to look squarely at what was happening to the young black people I knew in the South, and to write honestly about that, how to be an Old Testament god. To avoid all of this, I drank."
So, what happened to change your mind? When did you stop not writing about real life stuff and write about really, really real life stuff?
I actually think that I came to that conclusion between the writing of my first and second novels, right? So after I had written Where the Line Bleeds and then before I wrote Salvage the Bones. And maybe partly why I'd come to that conclusion is because during that gap, like that's when, you know, that's when most of my, you know, I lost like three of my friends during that gap. And so I think that, you know, that affected me. Like that made me realize that I couldn't spare the people that I, the characters that I wrote about. I mean, if these characters were a true representation of the kinds of people, you know, in my family, in my community, et cetera, then I had to be truthful, you know, like I had to tell the truth about the reality of our experiences. And so it felt like a responsibility. I keep using that word. It did. It felt like a responsibility. And so when I wrote Salvage the Bones, I thought, okay, I have to let the characters come alive. I have to let the story come alive. It has to have muscle. And whatever happens, it happens. You know, this is a reflection of my community and of our experience.
That's novelist Jesmyn Ward speaking in 2014 with my colleague Celeste Headley. Her latest novel is Sing, Unburied, Sing. Ward speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at the Carter Center in Atlanta. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Tomorrow, we meet Mastodon's drummer. The Atlanta-based heavy metal group formed nearly two decades ago and has developed a massive following. We want to hear from the fans. What does Mastodon's music mean to you? How about Bron Daler's drumming, his incredible tenor singing? Do you have a favorite song by Mastodon? Call us at 404-500-9457. Or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. A popular show with a familiar title wraps up its second season tonight. Since FX debuted Atlanta in 2016, it has racked up multiple awards and critical acclaim. The series showcases humor, Atlanta rap culture, and serious social issues. Here's a clip from this season.
Florida Man is responsible for a large percentage of abnormal incidents that occur in Florida. Think of him as a alt-right Johnny Appleseed. No one knows his true identity, date of birth, what he looks like. That's why headlines always say Florida Man. Florida Man shoots unarmed black teenager.
FX's Atlanta presents an authentic and nuanced perspective on actual Atlanta, especially its black community. That community is also well represented behind the scenes. The show is set in Atlanta and shot in Atlanta. Joel Ray Ishman and Quellen Bradley work as stand-in actors on the program. On Second Thought, contributor Kalina Bowler talked with them about their experiences working on the show's second season. Quellen says there was something magical about it even before filming began.
So I started during the pilot, and it was a very hot summer in Atlanta with Joel, actually. And the very first day, we were reading over the sides, and we were like, this show is going to blow up. Mm-hmm. Like, we knew it from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And since then, working the entire pilot, working the entire first season, and now the entire second season, that same feeling that we had on the first day about the level of consciousness that this story and this the storytelling of the crew and the cast and everything, but also the level of commitment and discipline that everyone has to creating a great show that's impactful, that reflects Atlanta well, but it's also funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare. But I feel like from the very beginning, we had that conversation and nothing's changed.
Yep.
That's amazing. And Joel, Paperboy is... he's a phenomenon now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're referencing Paperboy across all media right now. How was it being hired to play this now iconic role?
Well, I mean, definitely shout out to Brian Tyree Henry. he's a good guy. He's a good guy first.
Yeah.
And then he's an amazing actor as well. You know, he's done Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
He played in the Book of Mormon on Broadway. So he's classically trained as an actor. So just watching his performance, it's inspiring to see, you know.
When you're called in and they say, all right, we need the stand-ins.
Mm-hmm. Second team.
Do you guys imagine yourselves as the characters, or do you imagine yourselves as the actors portraying the characters when you do your stand-ins?
I think, first of all, for me...
Or is it literally just standing there?
No. like some productions, that's all you do, but those productions don't understand the art of blocking, and blocking is an art.
Right.
But for this one, because we're working with artist Hiro Murai, who's the director, is amazing, and he's worked with Donald Glover on multiple videos, and so they have a lot of nonverbals. But when we actually get the script, we actually go over the lines. When I do it as myself. I don't want to replicate anything that Lakeith would do, because he's artistically, he's one of the, to me, he's like an artistic genius. Like, he knows his beats, he knows what's going on. So when I get it as an artist, I bring my own flavor to it, and I go through the same beats, but I make it my own.
Is definitely a process of collaboration. And, you know, because we are actors as well, we definitely bring our own flavor to those characters, so that even with Hiro and even with the cast, they sometimes can see what we do and say, I like that.
All right. Well, let me ask you guys this, because you're shedding light on what a stand-in is there for.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to walk me through...
the technical aspect of
like
standing
the day.
In. Yeah.
So let's just say it's production day 5 of 80 or whatever. And It's the day. The call is in. Everybody's like, okay, call time is 7 a.m. It's 7 a.m.
Yeah.
What happens? How do you guys get to work?
Go ahead, Q. Touch on.
All right, so I'll make it quick. Get to work. We go to wardrobe, get our color cover.
Make sure covers. Explain what color covers are.
Make sure that we look like the character so that the colors that we're wearing match the actor's
So you wear the exact
costume.
Same wardrobe?
It's similar colored wardrobe.
Like if the character is wearing a brown shirt, we'll go and get a brown shirt from.
But it's not necessarily the exact same. As long as it's okay.
Unless we're doing photo doubling, which is a whole another thing where we have the exact same look. But for the most part, typical day, we'll just go and make sure the color cover matches so that the color looks right when we're setting up the shot. We'll get our sides. We'll read over the entire sides for the entire
day.
I'm sorry for those not in the industry. It's just basically your script for the day. Every scene in order from where you're going to shoot it. And so we go over that. We memorize every single
we do. Explain why we do that, Q.
Because the standing role is, it's so important. And that's why I say blocking is an art. And people that have that utilize stand-ins the proper way, the production runs so much more smoother because you're the guy that's in there while the actor's like, you know, going over their performance.
They're getting hair and makeup done, making sure their wardrobe is good.
Right. You're the guy that's in there that's making sure that the light hits them right. You're the one that making sure that that you hit your mark right. And when you hit that mark at a certain line, the focus perilla is going to do something during that time. So they need to hear that line at that mark, or they need to hear not even only marks, and they need to hear a line when you pick up something, and they need to make sure the camera's getting it, make sure the lighting is getting it. So it's extremely technical, but at the same time, it's so necessary because people look at our day like, oh, it's TV, it's no big deal. No, there's 12, at least 12 hour days. We're actually going at over least 2-3 scenes, and that's it, because we want to make sure that every shot is thought about. You know, every part of the blocking, and that's what we're there for, is storytelling. So there's a reason why, for example, you hit a mark during this line instead of another line. That's why it's so important for us to know what's happening, what's going on. So we set up shots throughout the day, and we just do it over and over. Every single shot, every single turn of the camera, they bring us in to make sure that the blocking is right.
Everything is rehearsed. We go through the lines. We memorize the lines because it just makes it easier for us and the crew to go through the actual lines so that everybody can get everything set as far as camera movement and shots and the lighting. So
you're literally not just standing. You're acting.
You're acting.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just we not on camera.
Acting. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So that's the technical setup of a stand-in.
I love it.
So.
And to be honest, I had no idea. And I've been doing this now 15 years. I didn't know.
There's basically a stand-in on every production. Check this out. Samuel L. Jackson was Bill Cosby's stand-in on The Cosby Show.
And then Anthony Mackie was Samuel L. Jackson's stand-in as well on many productions.
Yeah.
So it's such a good proving ground and training ground for developing actors.
Yeah.
So they can understand the art of being on TV film.
Samuel Jackson used to wear the sweaters and everything.
Y'all are blowing my mind because that's amazing. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Wow. So you would then suggest this for people who want to act and want to get into it?
100%. Not only does it sharpen your skills, it gives you that on-set experience. So then when you are called to be part of a cast or to do first team, you have on-set experience, actual on-set experience of what your day as a cast member is going to be.
And Q, talk to me about so far the best experience that you have had as a stand-in on any show that you've worked on, TV or movies. Go ahead, Q.
Yeah, I just finished the last major film that I did was Black Panther, and I was a stand-in for Chadwick Boseman. It was such a benefit as an actor to work so closely with a cinematographer and a director and a first AD that is visionary, and we understand, and I could understand how they put shots together. I could understand how the whole world came together through their eyes, and that experience is invaluable.
Right. That's amazing. How about you?
Yeah. For me, my best experience would be Atlanta. And I've had some great experiences on other shows as a stand-in just because of how I approach the stand-in position. I was a stand-in on a Ricky Smiley show for 3 seasons, and that was great. Great crew, great cast. And Atlanta is pretty much the same. It's a small crew. It's a small crew for a TV show. And then also the head honcho, Donald Glover, he's a humble guy. When we were on set and we got word of his Grammy nominations, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? And I was like, hey, man, that's a good look, man. He was like, yeah, man, so, you know, it's a lot of good people in the categories. You know, he's that type of guy. Like, dude, you just got nominated for 5 Grammys and you on your own hit TV show. He could be a certain way if he wanted to, but he's just a cool dude. He's just a regular, humble guy. And so because he's the boss, everybody under him is humble and cool as well. So, like, even if you come on set and you don't have that peaceful, humble attitude, mm-hmm. you stand out in a bad way because the top dog is like, you know, how y'all doing? You know, he speaks to everybody, and, you know, it's that type of vibe on set. It's definitely for the culture. So that experience, just seeing somebody as young as Donald doing what he loves to do in a position that he's in, writer, producer, actor. It's just a special vibe on set that everybody contributes to. So it's a great experience, man.
That's Joel Ray Ishman and Quellen Bradley. They are stand-in actors on FX's Atlanta, which airs its season finale tonight. They spoke to On Second Thought contributor Kalina Bowler. Kalina is the host of The Credits Podcast. Listen online at thecreditspodcast.com. And finally today, we go from TV to the stage. It's National Historic Preservation Month, and we take time this week to honor historic Georgia theaters. In Macon, where I am based, the Douglas Theater was an important 20th century showplace for African American artists. The Douglas hosted performers like Bessie Smith, Little Richard, and Otis Redding. Alan Walden helped start Capricorn Records, and he was Redding's manager. Walden, who is white, says growing up he couldn't go to the Douglas, but that never stopped him from getting a preview of the live acts.
My name is Alan Walden, and I'm 2003 inductee into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame. My brother and I were not allowed to go into the Douglas. We had to sit at what was Trailways bus station in those days, which was across the street from the Douglas. And we had to sit in the Trailways parking area and listen to the act singing. It was one of the first black theaters that did live entertainment. It was the place where I say Otis Redding started and Little Richard started. I mean, they were both in their upcoming years when they played there. I remember hearing Otis Redding performing at the Douglas. One of the best songs that I heard Otis perform at the Douglas was a song called She's All Right. And then he had the one that was on Confederate label, which was Shout Bama Lama and Fat Cow. I
after we're going to walk up again. He always knew that he wanted to be a singer. I mean, from a little boy up. And Otis would only hold a job about a week, get his paycheck and change jobs the next week. But he always was singing. And the Douglas was a big one because it was one of the nicer venues that he played at the time. And he packed it. And not only that, but he rocked them when they were there. They used to call him Rock House Redding. But Otis was a most wonderful human being I ever knew in my life. I mean, this man was my best friend in life. I taught him how to ride horses, fish, and hunt, and he taught me how to write songs. And we had a wonderful relationship. I feared no man with Otis Redding by my side. I love that theater. I'd rather go there than go to the Grand. Douglas is one of my favorite places to go. I go down and participate in just about everything they ask me to do down there. And I feel like I'm kind of at home when I'm there.
That was veteran music manager Alan Walden sharing his memories of the historic Douglas Theater in Macon. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. And that's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you. What's a building in your community that we should know about? Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or you can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk. You can reach us on Facebook as well. On Second Thought is produced by Fenley Fox and LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show. Tanya Ott is the executive producer. And the engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to the interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.